website, Jacob, they can go to learn more and to visit you.
They can go. Yeah, they can go to my website, which is jacoblieberman.org. That's O-R-G. And Lieberman is spelled L-I-B-E-R-M-A-N. And don't be afraid to go. This is not a website that's trying to sell you a bunch of stuff. It's beautiful. It's colorful. It's just something nice to look at.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't
you know we're gonna have a Solartopia.
Started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with the legendary Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote the great lyrics to that Solartopia song. It's a Grammy winner on the Tomorrow's Children album from Appleseed Records. We got a great show today. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you in Solartopia for another hour here at PRN, Progressive Radio Network. Thanks to the guys in New York, the crew, and we are on with an amazing person, Dick Munson. Dick, you with us?
I am, Harvey. How are you?
And are you in the windy city of Chicago?
I am. Glorious day here.
Well, tonight's been here in Los Angeles, and we got the crew in New York, so we're spread right across the country. And I got a full hour with you, and we got a ton to talk about. First, I do want to celebrate one thing. I have a show at KPFK in Los Angeles, and we have been campaigning to save a 100-year-old sycamore tree, a California sycamore tree in Santa Monica, which was threatened. The people bought the property, claimed that they weren't going to cut the tree down, but of course they're house flippers, and that's exactly what they were going to do. And in fact, one day a crew showed up with chainsaws in hand, ready to cut this thing down, and a local woman, a neighbor, saw them and ran out and stood in front of the tree, by God, stopped them from cutting it down. So on Monday night, the Santa Monica City Council designated this tree a special monument, whatever you want to call it, and it will be preserved. So, folks, we do win things. I realize this is just a single tree, and it is a 100-year-old sycamore tree. It will hopefully, God willing, live to 200 years. And we do win some victories. We also won a major one. We've got $500,000 set aside in the city of Los Angeles to push sustainability, and especially in terms of renewable energy. So there are little pockets of resistance where we do win these victories. We are still alive on this planet to a certain extent. And Dick Munson, you are one of the reasons that continues to be the case.
You're very kind, but let me say congratulations on saving the tree. There are some, as you well know, lovely trees up on the Mesa in Santa Monica. It's a glorious city and lots of trees that need to be preserved.
Mm-hmm. Well, the same is true in Chicago and all around this country. I mean, I think that basically, to me, trees are the essence of life on Earth. I know that's a kind of one of those broad statements, but obviously, without trees, we would be nowhere. We wouldn't be here. I think trees are maybe. I think we may find one of these days that trees are among the most intelligent creatures that we have. We just quite don't know how to communicate with them yet, but someday we will.
Well, every day my hat that I wear is from the Morton Arboretum, and on the back of it says plant trees, so I'm totally with you.
Well, there you go. And I remember being on some controlled substances back in the 60s and thinking I was conversing with the trees, so maybe we'll, the circle will come around on that one. At any rate, you've been active for how long have you been active, Dick? You've just been on this for so long.
It's been quite some time. Let's just leave it at that.
We won't belie your age, but I know that you were definitely involved in saving the Earth in the previous century, and here you are. So we want to talk about two major things today. You have a new book out about Nikola Tesla, which is fantastic. Tell us a bit about this book, if you would.
Well, Tesla, I think, you know, most people who have some understanding of him recognize that he's the one that gave us the electric motor, long-distance electricity transmission, actually radio, robots, remote control. I mean, he was a brilliant mastermind, a bit underappreciated. But particularly for this show, I think the one thing that most people probably don't know was that he was a clean energy pioneer and actually remains, I think, an inspiration to today's solar and battery entrepreneurs, including Elon Musk, for instance, who calls him a hero and contributed about $1 million to help restore Tesla's laboratory up on Long Island.
Wow. Well, tell us, first of all, tell us the title of the book, the publisher, how people can get it.
Well, the title is Tesla, Inventor of the Modern. It's being published by W.W. Norton. It officially gets released on Tuesday, but people can go to a website, tesla-book.com, and read the reviews and see where I am on speaking tours and possible ways of buying the book from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your local independent bookstore.
Tell us a few of the places you're going to be on tour.
Well, I've got several events in Chicago, which is where I am based, and then I'm going to the Boston Museum of Science. I'll be at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington, D.C. I'll be at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco doing a variety of events in both Cleveland and Columbus, Ohio. They have me busy, but I guess, you know, underlying this, the reason I'm sort of excited about it is I think that Tesla doesn't get the credit that he deserves. I mean, when you think about electricity, most people think of Thomas Edison. When you think about radio, most people think about Marconi. But the Supreme Court ruled that it was Tesla's patents that actually first identified how to transmit signals wirelessly over long distances. So my hope is that the book is obviously entertaining, but also gives credit to a mastermind that has been somewhat underappreciated.
Well, it's interesting. You sent me an email that you were going to see me in Columbus, but I know I live in Columbus. I'm here in Los Angeles. Do you have any events out in Los Angeles yet?
I don't have any in Los Angeles yet, but noting that that's where I was born and raised, I certainly hope to get some out there because I'd love to come back and visit friends and family.
All right, well, let's be in touch about that. When you're in San Francisco, we can bring you down to L.A. I just actually saw a one-man show with a guy named Ian Ruskin who has been doing a lot of Tom Paine one-man shows. And Ian did a portrayal of Nikola Tesla's wife, which is pretty amazing. And when we're done, we're going to talk about Tesla, and then you and I will also talk about, since we do have a full hour to talk about what's happening with the nuclear power industry. But there is a tremendous fascination with Nikola Tesla now. He was born, why don't you tell us where he was born? Tell us a bit about his wife. And then we'll
He's a Serb, but he was born in Croatia. Oddly enough, you could call it apocryphal or maybe just appropriate, but he was actually born during the midst of a violent lightning storm, exactly at the stroke of midnight, so between the 9th and the 10th of July 1856. And I think that tale, the weirdness of his birth during this midnight gale, became part of Tesla family lore, convinced him that he was special. The birth story also, I think, as you know, his biographer, I think, also places him both in the present as well as the future, both of today and tomorrow, and particularly his need to find, if you will, a balance between focusing on the current realities of life and envisioning the future, which is what he was best at.
Wow. And so, he was very well educated, right? I mean, he went to a, he had tech.
No, he was very well educated. He could speak eight languages fluently. He could recite lengthy poems and all short stories from memory. Oddly enough, it's, I think, this mix of his love of the humanities as well as his love of science that led to many of his discoveries. The revolutionary electric motor that he devised, he actually envisioned while walking through a Budapest park while quoting Goethe's Faust, that lengthy poem. So he's a unique inventor, but I think that that mix of humanities and science, his idealism towards you know, inventing being something more than just making a profit, but in fact bringing something to the world is inspiring and I think a useful model for some of our challenges today.
Well, he never married and he never had kids. Is that right?
He did not. He was a germaphobe in part because there were a couple of times when he was young, he had malaria and cholera. And just became, you know, convinced that he couldn't shake hands or touch other people. He also, I mean, this is, it was a weird situation in his upbringing. He had an older brother, Dane was his name, he was about 5 years older, who died when the family's Arabian stallion bolted one day. And I guess you would think that the family would then turn towards the remaining son, Nicola. But in fact, they just focused their attention on what could have happened if Dane had lived. And so Tesla says that his constant pressure that he felt to meet his father's expectations led him to have visions, but also led him to have a lot of quirks. I mean, he could not stand seeing pearls on a woman. He would start to throw up if he, you know, saw a peach. He would, on walks, need to count his steps and make sure that they were divisible by three, or he'd, you know, redo his adventure. So he does have his quirks, and yet at the same time, this mix of, you know, the electric motor, electricity, robots, remote control, and radio are the very foundations of our modern economy. So, you know, as
amazing.
A biographer, it was he is a great subject to explore both his life and his accomplishments.
All right, so let's trace it out. Politically, it's very interesting, you know, because I'm a historian. I have read a lot about Edison and Tesla, Morgan, and Westinghouse. And the single most important thing, I guess you could say, the single most impactful thing that Tesla was involved in, at least in terms of our economy, was the harnessing of the electricity at Niagara Falls, which was the first really big central power plant in the world, actually. Do you want to tell the story of the dynamic between Edison, Tesla, Westinghouse, and Morgan?
Tesla actually came to the United States at the recommendation of his European employers, who he was helping install Edison phone systems in Budapest and Paris. So he worked actually for Thomas Edison for a while, and the two of them just could never get along. They had different temperaments. Edison was rather slovenly and crass, to be quite honest, and Tesla appeared, you know, like an impeccable intellectual that spoke eight languages and always was dressed as though he was ready to go to the opera. But their biggest argument was they had different visions of how to transmit electricity. Edison thought that it needed to be done by something called direct current, which doesn't have much push, so that it would only go for short distances, and you'd have to have a whole lot of power plants or have electricity be limited just to the wealthy. Tesla, in contrast, favored alternating current that could be what's called stepped up or accelerated in its voltage and be sent over longer distance. And you referenced, you know, the big longer distance and probably the you know, engineering accomplishment of the 19th century was his tapping the power of Niagara Falls and first sending it 26 miles to Buffalo, but then not long afterwards, an amazing distance all the way down to New York City itself and lit Broadway and made the city what it is today.
How many miles is it from Niagara Falls to New York City? It must be about 400 or 500, yeah?
I should know that off the top of my head. I would guess about 400, but when you were realizing that, you know, the Edison system could basically go maybe about a half a mile, the ability to develop alternating current and all the equipment associated with it and send it, say, 400 miles was a remarkable change and created our electricity industry, which, you know, at the time, electricity, and still is an amazing resource in the sense of the drudgery-reducing applications that it can provide, and it underpins our current, you know, modern society with our computers and our robots and, you know, the cloud and everything else. So the battle of the currents, as it was called, between Edison and Tesla was fierce. Edison was this, you know, somewhat cranky old man who, with the support of J.P. Morgan, wanted to protect his investments, and his investments were in direct current. And so he tried to make it appear as though alternating current was incredibly dangerous. And so he would find an associate of his that would use alternating current and would electrocute dogs or monkeys or, you know, a whole variety of other animals and grotesque things. And in fact, convinced the state of New York that they should, instead of hanging people or shooting criminals, they should electrocute them. And Westinghouse was the ally of Tesla at this point. And so Edison, to criticize this alternating current, would suggest that that the electrocution process be called, someone would be Westinghoused. Fortunately, for, you know, all of our perspectives, you know, Westinghouse and Edison had the better technology and eventually won out. And as you noted, with the major accomplishment of sending power that long distance from Niagara Falls all the way down to New York City.
Well, Edison was not really a very nice guy, and neither was Morgan. So here's my understanding of what happened at Niagara Falls, and please correct me, Dick Munson, if I'm wrong. Dick, we're talking with Dick Munson from Chicago. Dick is the author of a new biography of Nikola Tesla, who really has become a legendary figure in the last 20, 30 years. You know, and conspiracy theorists love to talk about how he was murdered and all that stuff, and we'll get to that in a minute. But my understanding is that when it became clear that electricity was going to be a big deal, and that a huge amount of power could be generated from Niagara Falls, the government put out a contract. I guess it was the federal government. I don't think it was the government of the state of New York, but you would probably know better than me. And a bid was put out, a request for bids, to take the power, turn Niagara Falls into a power station, and send the power as far as it could go. And so J.P. Morgan, the hugely probably the richest man in America alongside Carnegie, well, definitely the richest man in America alongside Carnegie and Rockefeller, was the backer of Thomas Edison. And actually, J.P. Morgan's house on Fifth Avenue, my understanding, Dick, was the very first house in the world to be powered by electricity. I mean, he had a generator in the basement that Morgan had Edison build, right? So Morgan and Edison were basically partners. Edison was backed by Morgan. And Tesla had been Edison's assistant, right? And didn't they have a deal? Edison offer Tesla a deal to figure out how to transmit electricity?
He actually had a deal. He promised Tesla that he'd pay him $50,000 if he could dramatically increase the efficiency or the output of his dynamos or the generators. You got to have some hesitation about this story. That was a lot of money back then, and Edison was notoriously cheap. So, Whether the story is true, at least from Tesla's perspective, he, in fact, vastly increased, like by 3 times, the efficiency of these dynamos and went to Thomas Edison and said, you know, we had a deal, you know, pay up the money. And at this point, you have to remember that Tesla admired Edison, just thought that he was, you know, the wizard. Edison basically stood up and started laughing at poor Nikola Tesla, and who was a new immigrant to the country, and basically said, you know, when you become an American, you will appreciate an American joke. And refused to give him any additional money. As you might imagine, Tesla picked up his bowler hat, since he was often well-dressed, left, and started his own company.
Did Edison use what Tesla had discovered?
He only did later, after he lost the War of the Currents. So after the Niagara Falls accomplishment, Edison really moved on to other things, but his companies then realized that indeed alternating current was the way to go, so they began to adopt it. But Edison fought it for, you know, as long as he could, until he realized that it was just the superior technology.
God. Well, correct me if I'm wrong. Now, my understanding is that Edison and Morgan bid on the Niagara Falls contract. And
they did.
George Westinghouse, who had, I think Westinghouse had developed the braking systems for railroads, for mm-hmm. the trains. And so Tesla went to him, or vice versa, they were partners. And Tesla and Westinghouse also bid in Niagara Falls, and they completely blew Morgan and Edison away, and they got the contract. Is that right?
That's exactly right. And the first, just before this, the other thing that sort of tipped the scales is that in 1893, there was the Columbian Exposition, actually here in Chicago. It was the World's Fair. Uh-huh. And it was, as you can imagine, Chicago was still a young, vibrant city, and they wanted to sort of declare to the world that, you know, they were, you know, on the cutting edge of technology. So they really wanted this fair to be powered by electricity. So there was a lot of competition between Westinghouse with Tesla and Edison and J.P. Morgan over who would get the contract to power the Columbian Exposition. And Westinghouse basically underbid Edison, saying that he would probably lose money in the process, but that it was just so worth it to be able to have this high-profile, you know, event that would feature his technology. And it was that time where, you know, millions of visitors from around the world came to see, a display of light such that they had never seen before, and all powered by, you know, a single control unit that monitored the generators and sent the electricity throughout the park. In fact, the park was consuming 3 times more electricity than the entire city of Chicago during that period. So it was the technological accomplishment that I think put both Tesla and Westinghouse in good stead to win the contract for Niagara Falls.
Wow. And who built the light bulbs? Were they Edison light bulbs at the Chicago Fair?
No, Edison lawyers basically said, if you use anything that even comes close to looking like our light bulbs, we'll sue the living daylights out of you. And so Tesla and Westinghouse developed something they called a stopper lamp, which essentially was not as good, to be quite honest, as the Edison lamp, because they tended to leak a little bit into the vacuum. And so Westinghouse was so adamant about winning this, he would, every evening, he would send a train back to Pittsburgh with the burned out bulbs, and in the morning come back with a train from his Pittsburgh factories with new bulbs, which would substitute for them. So he was willing to go not only underbid Edison, but go to extreme lengths to make sure that his technologies, including, you know, perhaps in this case not superior bulbs, were available to light the park.
Well, it's too bad he didn't come up with LED at the time.
Yeah.
That would have made a big difference. So my understanding now, and you mentioned lawsuits, is that after Westinghouse and Tesla won the contract from Niagara Falls, which was a huge deal. I mean, this is the biggest step forward in the technology, one of the biggest steps forward in American technology in all of world history, that Morgan went to Westinghouse and said he was going to sue. And then Westinghouse said, well, what for? And Morgan said, doesn't matter. I have more money than you do. And I'm just going to sue you until I get a hold of your company. Is that essentially what happened?
He certainly threatened lawsuits. He also, not long after the Niagara Falls project was done, you know, the economy goes through cycles, and Westinghouse had been a bit overextended because he was spending so much money to prove this new technology. And as the economy fell, Westinghouse was a bit squeezed, and J.P. Morgan squeezed him as hard as he could to try to take over his company during this period. And this is when Tesla's fortunes changed. I mean, here he was at the top of his game. He, you know, had a good bit of money. He had this fantastic accomplishment. He was living high on the hog, eating at Delmonico's, had a lovely room at the Waldorf Astoria. But Westinghouse was in trouble, and his company was threatened because of Morgan. And so Westinghouse went to Tesla and said, you know, I know we've got this great contract, and there's this agreement that I will give you a royalty for every electric motor that I built according to your patents. But if my company is going to survive, I need to reduce it or get out of that. Tesla, idealistic non-businessman that he was, basically gave away billions of dollars and turned to Westinghouse, at least in, according to his tale, and said, you have been kind to me. You have been my supporter. You are the one that will bring my invention to the world. I'm willing to tear up the contract. And with that, to be quite honest, his fortunes changed. He lost what would have been billions of dollars. Westinghouse was able to keep his company, and sort of the rest is history.
Well, did Westinghouse ever go back to him and give him back some of the money?
No. It, in fact, I mean, the interactions between, you know, this group are very intriguing because at one point, not long after Niagara Falls, Tesla's Fifth Avenue Laboratory in New York City burned down. And you would think that Westinghouse, because Tesla saved his company and, you know, gave him the technology to grow, Westinghouse basically said, you know, we'll be glad to give you new equipment, but you have to buy it. Whereas Edison, who had been, you know, his enemy, and to be honest, he had been a good bit of a pisser, you know, turned to Tesla and said, you know, you need a laboratory for a while. Come use mine until, you know, you get back on your feet. So the dynamic of this group, you know, was odd, at least.
God, I never heard that part about Edison. That's interesting, because Edison, well, of course, and Morgan dumped Edison. Morgan, my understanding is Morgan kept Edison's name, and you put it on all the utility companies, but dumped Edison himself.
Well, yes, that was the whole fight about forming. I mean, J.P. Morgan loved to form trust. In other words, combinations of companies that would monopolize their particular industry, whether that was railroads or steel companies or what have you. He thought he would do the same for electrical equipment manufacturers and combined what had been Edison General Electric with Thomson Houston, which was their big competitor. And he made sure that Edison's name was no longer on the company. So it was called General Electric, not Edison General Electric. And Mr. Edison, who had a substantial ego, was not exactly pleased with this and went off to try other adventures, be that the phonograph or motion pictures or, you know, some busted things with, you know, ore mining improvements. So,
God, well, you can't denigrate Edison's accomplishments. I mean, he was a pretty incredible
No, I mean, and I don't, you know, both Edison and Marconi deserve great praise. I think my point is that Edison or Tesla's contributions have not been as acknowledged as they should, but that's not to, you know, to take away from, you know, the great work that those other two did.
Okay, so let's get down to it then. A lot of people believe the conspiracy theorists, the people who say that Edison was shafted, that Tesla was shafted, generally attributed to the idea that he had developed a technology where electricity could be distributed for free, and that the corporations didn't want this.
He did have this theory that he could build a large tower and send basically a lightning bolt into the earth. And because of the earth's natural electric charge and the use of resonance, which is basically an echo, he'd send this charge out and let it echo back across the earth, that he could create enough electrical power that anybody around the world could essentially plug into the earth and gain access to electric power. There are lots of different theories. J.P. Morgan did, in fact, invest in this. And there, this whole period where he was also investing in Marconi, and Marconi was making more progress on his, you know, advance of radio signals, even though he was using Tesla's, copyrights and patents to be able to do it. So, yes, there are those theories that, you know, J.P. Morgan basically thought that what Tesla was trying to do would destroy his ability to sell electricity and charge people for it. The counter argument is that, you know, Tesla just didn't deliver. You know, Marconi was making, you know, the serious advances, and Tesla was not able to demonstrate, for a variety of technical reasons, his grand plan for sending, you know, power through the earth and making it available free to everyone. So Morgan increasingly, you know, backed away from Tesla, and Tesla, you know, became more and more sort of angry and entrenched in his one big idea that at least this last one didn't work out.
Well, the idea that you could, what was the idea that he really believed in? That was his downfall. It was the idea that you could send out
electricity. That you could actually send electricity, a charge into the earth, and it would resonate throughout the interior core of the planet, and people then could tap into that electrical charge anywhere around the earth and basically pick up electricity for free.
Well, what do you think about that?
It appears as though he didn't, he sort of thought that the earth was this filled with a sort of a liquid like within a balloon, so that the waves would go back and forth and there wouldn't be any loss of it. But what I think what people began to find, as well as Tesla found, is that the earth wasn't that great of a conductor. In other words, it was more like an ocean where a wave would dissipate over a long distance. And so the idea, this particular one, just didn't pan out technologically. That's not to take away from, you know, his brilliance and his, you know, his other ideas that other, you know, people for generations developed that he had just, you know, sort of written out the outlines for, be that sonar or radar or, you know, even something like the internet and the smartphone or the smartwatch. But this particular one where he really, this was his one big idea. In the end, I think he got it wrong.
Well, Guy, also, I mean, what would have been the biological impact of dumping a huge charge into the earth? I mean, to fry all the earthworms? I mean, come on.
We will never know. Well, at least in Tesla's time, did not find out what the implications are. I mean, when he did do this, you know, in Colorado Springs was the first time that he set up such a laboratory in a tower and basically, you know, connected these lightning charges into the earth. You did see, you know, butterflies go crazy. You saw horses with their iron shoes, you know, bolt. You did see, you know, about 20 different bulbs that were about a half a mile away from the laboratory that were plugged into the earth. They did, in fact, glow. So there's something to it as to whether we would have lost all the earthworms. I don't think we he went that far that we'll never know that one.
Yeah, well, and, you know, I mean, there's a lot of discussion today about microwaves and the biological impacts of cell phones, things like that. I mean, maybe it's best he didn't succeed.
I mean, what near the end of his life when he, you know, to be honest, was getting old and also a little senile, but he went in and out of, you know, being brilliant and being a little bit crazy. He would give annual talks to reporters, about 50 of them would show up every year on his birthday and listen to him think about the future. And these would be like multiple hour events with this guy in his 70s, you know, coming up with notions of, you know, sonar or radar or other things. But the one that was of particular controversy late in life is that he claimed to have devised a death beam, not too dissimilar from what happened under the Reagan administration with Star Wars, this weapon that could kill, you know, troops and shoot down airplanes and knock out boats. And so at his death, the FBI was so worried that this was possibly true that they confiscated all of his, you know, records. And you'll love this one, and hired an MIT professor to spend some time going through his various documents to see if, in fact, this was real enough and something that we needed to protect so that, you know, during the beginning of World War II, this was about the time that Tesla was to die, that this information would not be made available to our enemies. And so this MIT professor, the head of their, you know, high energy laboratory, his name was John Trump, and he did decide that one of the documents that Tesla came up with was so clear in its outline for what this death beam would be that he placed a top secret classification on it. The other things he basically said were items that were, you know, just the ramblings of an old man and nothing all that startling. What's intriguing here is, and you'll love this one, is that John Trump is actually the uncle of the current president of the United States. And that,
oh my God,
while he was campaigning, you might recall, suggested that he had an uncle who was an MIT professor, and that was used as a justification to show how smart Donald Trump, in fact, was, because he came from a family of great intellectual genes.
Holy God, that's really astounding. I mean, so this guy, John Trump, was Donald Trump's father's brother?
Yes, I believe that's true.
Because Donald Trump's father was basically a mafia builder in New York City. That's really mind-boggling. Dick,
it is
is that in your book?
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah. I'm trying to, if you give me just 1 second, I can think. He, you know, the current president has this great line, which unfortunately I'm not finding it right away. But it was simply bragging that, you know, how smart he was and how educated he was, that he had these, you know, connections to brilliant MIT scientists.
Oh my, that is really shocking. For this, literally answering your way. Talking with Dick Munson, author of a new book on Nikola Tesla, coming out from, who's the publisher?
W.W. Norton.
Norton.
And again, you can find both reviews and, you know, schedules and order forms at a site, tesla-book.com.
So how long did you work on this book?
Well, I have a day job, so this was done on the weekends, and it probably took about 4 years or so. One of the real blessings was that I had not realized that there were these collections of letters that Tesla wrote to his friends, to his business colleagues, to J.P. Morgan even, that are available at the Smithsonian Institution in the Library of Congress. So from a biographer's perspective, there was a gold mine of, you know, sort of firsthand, you know, commentary on Tesla's life from him, as well as he seemed to collect a lot of letters that got sent to him as well. So that was a real blessing and really helped.
Wow, fantastic. The thing that Trump's uncle found, was anything like a laser beam that that Tesla had discovered?
Yes, no, it's right along that line. I don't know for sure because it slapped on with a, you know, top secret clearance. So we don't know exactly what it is. There are numerous, there's been some movies and other theories of, you know, conspiracies associated with what it might have been. There was two FBI agents who, not long after reviewing the files with Professor Trump, you know, were sent off on a mission to see General Dwight Eisenhower and sort of brief him on what they found. And their plane mysteriously disappeared over the Atlantic Ocean, which only adds to the conspiracy theories associated with what possibly was this weapon and who was going to what lengths to try to keep it a secret.
Well, it's 70 years ago. It hasn't been declassified?
It has not, to the best of my knowledge. I think that it maintains that classification.
God, that's really wild. I mean, maybe it's something that still hasn't even been developed yet. That's amazing.
Well, again, I think, you know, Tesla came up with some pretty crazy things. I mean, he thought that you could read somebody's mind by putting a little monitor on their retina. You know, he thought that you could communicate with intelligent beings on other planets. So, he was out there sometimes, but he also came up with ideas. I mean, he has one description that you would swear was a description of a cell phone, basically something large enough that would fit in your shirt pocket that would allow you to obtain news and, you know, have conversations with anybody anywhere around the world. He did that, you know, probably 60, 70 years before it had ever been thought of that you could do something like this. So it's this odd mix, and it's not like unlike any inventor. I mean, you know, the great ones, even the great ones have things that flop, but Tesla happened to have a whole lot more successes and brilliant insights that inspired others than I think most any other inventor I can think of.
Got it. Well, of course, in this Ian Ruskin show, which I saw last weekend, they made a reference to that. And told everybody, of course, to turn off their cell phone. But they did read the verbatim description that Tesla had written about, and, you know, a device that very much is like a cell phone. It's pretty amazing. But he didn't invent anything that came close to a cell phone in practical terms.
No. But, I mean, again, I think the issue here is, I mean, his practical things, of course, were radio and electric motors and robots and you know, the underpinnings of our modern economy. My suggestion is that he had envisioned other possible technologies that he didn't end up developing, but I think inspired great minds over the years to, you know, capture and develop.
Amazing. Of course, my great hero is Ben Franklin, and Franklin was every bit the genius that Tesla was, but managed to live not only a sane but an incredibly productive life, and was a civic genius as well as a technological genius.
You would note, as a writer, also a great one with a wry sense of humor that, as well as his diplomatic skills, no argument on that front.
Oh, no, yeah. Ben Franklin was every bit the civic genius that he was the technological genius, and he also had an accolade, you know, I won't call him a disciple, a student named Tom Paine, who, you know, was, well, we don't even have to discuss Tom Paine. He was on another level. So ironically, the guy who does the show, which you should see at some point, Dick, Ian Ruskin on Tesla, also did a show on Tom Paine. We're talking with Dick Munson, author of a new book on Nikola Tesla from Norton, just being published. I'm sure it's a great one. We also talked about George Westinghouse. Westinghouse was Tesla's backer, and in that the critical moments at the Chicago World's Fair and then at the harnessing of the electricity at Niagara Falls. And let's just segue over. Westinghouse's company, which Tesla, I guess, basically saved by throwing in his royalty deal, has finally reached its demise as a result of atomic power. And you, Dick Munson, have been a part of that. Can you tell us where we are now? You're with the Environmental Defense Fund. You've led the charge on converting our economy from atomic energy to fossil fuels to renewables. Where do we stand now with nuclear power and the transition to renewable energy?
I think the biggest threat is actually being considered in the White House at the moment. This Donald Trump, who's a great, his uncle did all this evaluation of Nikola Tesla's things. He is now considering a proposal that would have basically provided profit guarantee to all the coal and nuclear power plants forever in what's called the PJM service territory, which is this, you know, huge area throughout the Midwest and the Mid-Atlantic. Largely here, it's the result of lobbying by a single utility company called First Energy, which is based in Akron, Ohio. They made some really bad business decisions, particularly doubling down on coal at the very time that natural gas prices were falling, and therefore their coal plants, as well as their nuclear plants, just can't compete in open markets. And so they have been, for the last 4 years, seeking some subsidies, some bailout for their business mistakes. Because they weren't able to get those from Ohio legislators or Ohio regulators, at least to the extent that they wanted to. When Donald Trump became elected he had run on a platform of trying to preserve, you know, coal jobs and eliminate what he referred to as the war on coal, First Energy thought that they had an ally. And so suddenly we're at this stage where this is seriously, I think, an existential threat to clean energy projects, because Donald Trump, even though he ran as a conservative and supposedly appreciates the power of markets, is about to destroy power markets and tilt them dramatically in favor of old and dirty coal and nuclear power plants that are no longer economic. And if that is allowed to happen, as you might imagine, all other alternatives, be those natural gas as well as, you know, wind farms and solar collectors and batteries and everything else, will be put at a distinct disadvantage.
It's almost too much to even articulate.
It's also crazy. I mean, I think the Trump administration is grasping for some legal justification that halfway passes the laugh test to come up with a rationale for providing these bailouts. They're talking about using a Korean War law, era law that it was called the Defense Procurement Act, that was designed to allow the federal government to, you know, keep a stockpile of critical materials that would be necessary for the military during the midst of a war. They're thinking of using that law to justify them buying at, you know, very expensive prices, you know, electricity from coal and nuclear plants. Again, it just doesn't pass the legal laugh test, but the extent to which they are grasping to find something that will allow them to tilt the market away from clean energy and towards coal and nuclear power is really quite stunning and scary.
It's almost, you know, So basically, you got First Energy, which is just a blight on humanity. I mean, you know, we can say what we want about corporations in general. There are some corporations that are worse than others, and First Energy is just about not only as bad as you can get, it's about as bad as you can invent. I mean, if you were to envision the worst possible corporation, the least socially responsible, the most ecologically destructive, you would be hard pressed to invent something worse than First Energy.
And they are the subsidy seeker par excellence. You know, they, as I said, made bad business decisions, and instead of, you know, reducing the dividend that they would give to stockholders, reducing the compensation for their senior executives, they decided that they prefer getting it from taxpayers or, you know, charging ratepayers. The CEO of this company, during all this time when bad decisions were being made and bankruptcies have been declared, his salary continued to rise. He's now making $15 million a year for putting his company in peril and trying to transfer responsibility to taxpayers and ratepayers.
God, 15. I wonder what that works out to an hour.
You know, well, it's more than you and I make.
God almighty. I mean, okay, so they got the Perry nuclear plant near Cleveland, the Davis Bessie plant at Toledo, which is literally falling apart. They got two at Beaver Valley near Pittsburgh. Then they got, what, 60 or 70 coal burners. And they want these to be subsidized.
They not only want their own power plants to be subsidized, but they want every single coal and nuclear unit within this Midwest, Mid-Atlantic service territory to receive a profit guarantee. It's at about $8 billion a year forever. It really is quite stunning. And what's interesting here is that you see an amazingly odd coalition of opponents. You can imagine, you know, the competitive electricity suppliers who are generating their own power mostly from natural gas, you know, are aghast at this. The wind and solar industry is in absolute shock. You've got the American Petroleum Institute, which, you know, provides the natural gas for these now relatively inexpensive power plants. And then you've got these conservative think tanks, the Heritage Foundation, the R Street Institute, that are adamantly opposed to any effort to subsidize the uneconomic and to eliminate markets. So you've got this very diverse and odd set of characters that are basically saying to the Trump administration, number one, your rationale doesn't pass the laugh test, and number two, you will do long-term damage to the American economy and electricity markets if, in fact, you proceed down this stupid course.
God, it's just unbelievable. Dick Munson, we're almost out of time, unfortunately, to talk to you for another couple hours. You're with him, in addition to your authorship of this book on Tesla, you're the, tell us how to get a hold of you and what your organization is.
Well, I work for the Environmental Defense Fund. I'm a senior director based in Chicago, working on Midwest issues. I get to primarily focus on advancing clean energy in Illinois and Ohio. And, you know, returning back to the book, I mean, the book, again, is titled Tesla, Inventor of the Modern. It will be available in bookstores on Tuesday, to be quite honest, but also
well,
you can obtain information and ordering information at tesla-book.com.
What is the actual pub date?
Tuesday, the 22nd of May.
22nd of May, because this is podcast. And I've sent in, by the way, the description, so we can put it up right away, hopefully, and send it out. What is happening in Illinois and Ohio with the nuclear plants? In Illinois, I know there's been a bailout of the four nuclear reactors, three nuclear reactors, but it's also tied into some stuff with renewables. Can you describe what's going on in Illinois with nuclear power?
Illinois and Ohio are virtually the opposite when it comes to electricity policy. Illinois is actually making you know, thinking about how to make the system more efficient and clean, more reliable, et cetera. Ohio seems to be just filled with subsidy seekers looking backwards. In Illinois, about a couple of years ago, Exelon, the major generator, had, as you noted, several nuclear reactors that were also uneconomic that they were looking for subsidies for. But it was apparent that the clean energy community had enough political muster that that bill was not going to pass on its own. And we developed our own piece of legislation that was pro-renewable and pro-efficiency. And Exelon had enough political clout that our bill wasn't going to pass on its own. So didn't take an intellectual giant to think that we needed to go to the bargaining table. And I think, you know, from our perspective, it was a hard pill for a lot of people to swallow to provide some benefits to those reactors. But we calculated that at the end of the day, probably 75 to 80% of the benefits of the law, it's called the Future Energy Jobs Act, were for clean energy, renewables and efficiency. And the remainder were for some grid modernization efforts, as well as the benefits provided to Exelon's nuclear reactors. In Ohio, you know, First Energy, as you noted, just their business culture is one that they're not into negotiating or compromise. They think they can just get their way. So they never wanted to come to the negotiating table. And as a result, they haven't gotten what they've wanted out of even the very conservative Ohio legislature or Public Utility Commission.
What's going to happen with Trump and this push to bail out these nukes and coal plants?
I honestly don't know, and that's the fascinating part about, you know, doing public policy work. As I noted, that there is a growing, very powerful coalition that thinks the idea of bailing out or providing, you know, profit guarantees to these coal and nuclear units is just crazy. That said, you know, this president has you know, indicated that he wants to do something particularly for the coal industry. He seems to be less focused on the nuclear industry, but they are sort of tied at the hip on this one. So we're hearing from White House lawyers and others that they have a very hard time thinking about how any existing law can be used to make these bailouts happen. You know, predicting what the president himself will do on an issue like this, I just don't have the answer to that.
And, of course, we know that there is a provision in the Ohio Code that was prevents wind power from being built in northern Ohio, where $4 billion of investment is waiting to pour in to put in all sorts of wind power in northern Ohio.
There was actually just in the last couple of days, the Ohio State Legislature has introduced a bill that would reduce rather dramatically the standards for renewables and efficiency, but also allow more wind power to be developed.
Dick Munson, you're great. Thanks so much. Thank you, Crew in New York. We'll be back next week. In Solartopia. Keep up your great work.
Appreciate it. You take care. Thanks.
Take care.
Solartopia, don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world.
Well, we bit the apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we've found, but don't you know?